Case number 13-1219, Myersville Citizens for a Rural Community, Inc., et al. Petitioners versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Ms. Elefant for the petitioners, Ms. Larson for the respondent, Ms. Stetson for the intervener.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Good mid-afternoon, mid-morning, Your Honors. Carolyn Elefant.
It's still morning, but it might not be that much longer.
May it please the Court. Carolyn Elefant for the Myersville residents. I will be reserving a minute for rebuttal. Your Honors, I think we can all safely assume that nobody, my clients in particular, want a compressor station in their community. But what we can assume under the Natural Gas Act is whether there's a need for one. And for that reason, we are asking this court to closely scrutinize the evidentiary record on which FERC based its finding of need to determine whether there's substantial evidence, because we don't believe there is. That will be my first argument, and time permitting, my second argument will be that FERC's issuance of a conditioned certificate unlawfully interfered with Maryland's permitting process under the Clean Air Act, which is another federal statute.
Okay, and when you make your first point, you're going to explain to us why having contracts for 100% of the gas is not substantial evidence for the demand, right?
Yes, I will. Okay. Yes, I'm going
That's
to address
what you're
that.
Going to tell me? Okay, go ahead.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, first of all, it's not clear from the record whether those contracts are actually for 100%. Mm. These contracts, according to FERC, originated, and according to FERC in its orders and also in the FERC brief, originated out of the 2007 proposed storage factory. That storage factory was a 14,000 horsepower facility, and the support for that is in note 5 of our petition. It's a reference to the Federal Register, which shows that it's 14,000 horsepower. And there were three customers who were contracted for that at a total of 125,000 decatherms a day. This particular facility is 16,000. There's only two customers at 115,000 decatherms a day, and yet FERC continues to state that this is a contract for 100% of the capacity. So one of the problems that we're dealing with is in the absence of these precedent agreements in the record, it's really very difficult to tell whether the capacity for this particular facility is fully contracted.
Where did you argue to FERC that they needed to put the contracts in the record?
We raised the substantial evidence argument at the level of FERC, arguing that there was no substantial evidence in support of the finding of need. And we did put in a footnote questioning whether the precedent agreements were in the particular contract in the record at all. And I realize that there's some dispute over whether that constitutes adequate preservation. But the additional point is that even assuming that we didn't preserve the issue, it's difficult for me to understand how this court can affirm the FERC's finding can evaluate whether there's substantial evidence in the absence of these contracts being in the record. And the case that we cited for that proposition is Bangor Hydro. In that particular case, that was a case under the Federal Power Act. Under the Federal Power Act, the Department of Interior has the ability to propose fish ways to FERC, and it proposed fish ways where there really was very scant support as to the need for them. And FERC accepted that proposal, and it said, well, we don't have any choice. We have to include it under Section 18 of the Federal Power Act. And the court said, well, there doesn't appear to be any support for this in FERC. You have an independent obligation to ensure that there's substantial evidence in the record in support of your decisions. And, by the way, unfortunately, these interior the reports that were that had been purported to be in support of these fishways are not in the record. So the court wasn't able to affirm the decision because there wasn't substantial evidence in support of FERC's decision, and also because the basis, to the extent that there might have been substantial evidence arising out of those Department of Interior reports, those were absent also. And, in fact, the court did use the word unfortunately. So I think that there are some difficulties.
What happened in Bangor wasn't that you just have to put reports in records as a matter of law to have substantial evidence. It was that, in fact, it was the content of that report, the information about escapement rate that was not in the record, and the people, the challengers in that case had their own expert testimony that they put into the record disputing that information. And so it wasn't that you have to have that there. It's that you have to have the document there. It's simply that you have to have the information there in one form or another. And in this case, the information, FERC tells us, was there because Dominion said it had updated these contracts, renewed, they applied to this new operation, and the customers came in and said, that's right. So I don't think Bangor helps you in that regard. So why isn't Dominion saying the contracts are here, they've been updated, customers come in and saying, that's right, and you not offering any evidence to disbelieve that the full power, the 6,000 hours a year, is going to be used under those contracts?
Well, Your Honor, we have pointed to other conflicts in the record. Again, for example, I refer back to this agreement growing out of those original precedent agreements. There was not a second open season for this particular proposal. The first compressor station had 14,000 horsepower. This one has 16,000, even though it's serving a smaller load. In addition, if you take a look at FERC has referenced the two motions to intervene.
But I think that's a different I think you're making a different point now, and that is not that we don't agree that there's customers there that want to take it. We can't, FERC hasn't explained why they need 16,000 horsepower to provide what those customers need. Is that what your point is now?
The point is that FERC in this particular case relied on what Dominion told it to say that the agreements are fully subscribed. It's not clear from the record here whether FERC actually saw the contracts or just saw the summary of the contracts, but it appears that FERC's mantra throughout the case is that Dominion says that this project is fully subscribed and that's enough for us. Our argument is that, well, if this 16,000 horsepower facility is fully subscribed with two customers taking 115,000 decatherms a day, then how can you have had the 14,000 facility from which these agreements grew out of supporting three customers at 125,000? This is a larger facility. People are taking less. And so how could this one be fully subscribed when the other one had fewer customers? So that's one of the pieces of evidence that militates against what FERC had said.
I'm sorry. Was the other one limited to 6,000 hours? Was that original proposal going to be a year-round operation or unlimited? Or limited?
I don't recall. I believe it was a similar type of peaking operation, but I don't recall, and that is a good point. Another argument that we had made or that FERC had made is in the absence of these the precedent agreements, they referenced the Baltimore Gas and Electric and also Washington Gas motions almost as a proxy, and they said these two parties intervened in support. But if you look at what those interventions say, and one of them is in the supplemental joint appendix and one of them is in the main joint appendix, they didn't say we need this amount of power. That information was in the record. Presumably it wasn't confidential, yet these two entities were not willing to commit in their own motions in support of these agreements that they were going to take, I believe it was 15,000 in the case of Baltimore Gas and Electric and the remainder to Washington Gas. So they weren't willing to say that. So that's not really much evidence in support. And in fact, if you look at the FERC's certificate order, there was another challenger who made the point, it was in in the certificate order, he made the point and said something to the, it was one of the shippers, he said, well, I want to challenge this agreement, but the precedent agreements really don't let me interfere. So there's not a lot of credibility to be found citing the precedent agreements because the shippers who are parties to them often can't interfere with these agreements anyway and raise a problem with them.
Do you want to say something about the FERC's, about the certificate?
I'm sorry?
About the certificate. You want to move on
the
to
conditioned
yeah.
Certificate?
And in, I'll just tell you what my question is. Mm-hmm. Okay. The commission's position is that its authority, its statutory authority to issue conditional certificates includes the authority to issue a certificate conditional on state authority, even where the certificate itself makes state approval possible. So what's your argument that and FERC gets Chevron deference under this statute. So what in the statute prohibits FERC from doing that?
Well, in this particular case, FERC, first of all, the statute, the Natural Gas Act, preserves the state's authority under the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Coastal Zone Management Act. So the state's authority was preserved. So when FERC issued the conditioned certificate, it interfered with the state's ability to carry out its permitting function under the Clean Air Act, which is another federal statute. The second point is also that in this particular...
But the question more specifically is what prevents FERC in issuing a certificate from doing so in a way that affects state authority? And that really is the question. Our previous panel of our court said, Maryland, you tell us what's been preempted. And Maryland said basically everything. And you're coming in and saying that FERC somehow mandated that. And I guess the question is, what's your view that if that's what happened, that's impermissible under FERC's authorities?
Well, there were two points to that. First, as to your point, I read the Dominion case, the Summers case, a little bit differently. To me, what Summers said is, this case goes back, everything is presumptively preempted, and state, if you think there's a little tiny area you can carve out, maybe you can identify it. But to the extent that the statute that Maryland processes these permits under, Section 2-404B, says that it won't accept a permit unless it's in compliance with state law, the court pretty much said that this certificate essentially established that it was in compliance with state law. There was very little for Maryland to hold back. The second reason why it was problematic for FERC to go ahead and condition the certificate is because one of the findings that FERC made regarding the environmental impacts of this project was it assumed that it was going to operate for 6,000 hours a year. And when you're looking at clean air impacts, you really are looking at the potential to emit. And if the facility were operating every day, it would have a larger potential to emit. So the only way you can assume that 6,000 hours as your potential to emit is if it's codified within a federal permit. In order to get into that federal permit, it had to go through the state process.
Can I take you back to something you said earlier in response to Judge Pilger's question, and that is the relationship between your argument here and our decision in Dominion versus Summers? I didn't quite understand what you said, but my question is, isn't the position, if you're right, isn't Dominion versus Summers wrong? It says, presented with a FERC certificate that approves Dominion's compressor, the department must apply this standard to determine that. Isn't that wrong under your theory?
No, Your Honor. No? My theory is that if that's what Summers said, if that's, and that is what Summers said, it is,
yeah,
it is the law of the case. So if that is the position that Summers has taken, that once presented with a certificate, that invests a lot of, that really changes the whole dynamic of the FERC process because...
No, but this assumes that the certificate FERC issued was legal. That's what it says. It says, presented with a FERC certificate that approves, I mean, that's what they did here, and you're challenging that now, right? Aren't you arguing that conditional certificate was beyond FERC statutory authority?
I'm challenging, in Summers, they accepted that certificate at that time. It was still subject to review, it was still subject to different layers of review. There's always a possibility
review by whom? Other than the on-bank court and the Supreme Court, who?
No, this FERC, at the time that Summers ruled on the case, the Summers was decided in August of 2013. So at that time, the rehearing petitions were still pending. So there was always a possibility that that FERC certificate that the Summers court accepted and said preempted
that's
everything.
That's my point. You're saying, under your theory, the panel decision in Summers is wrong. Right? It has to be.
I'm thinking it through. So if they...
Because aren't we talking about the same certificate?
We're talking about...
Presented with a FERC certificate. That's this certificate that you're arguing.
Yes, and the
panel said that triggered these other responsibilities. Now, if you're right that FERC had no authority to issue that certificate, conditional certificate, then Summers is wrong.
No, Your Honor. The Summers court said, we're going to take this, we take the certificate and it deems everything to be preempted. What we're arguing is that it's not the Summers case that's wrong. It's because of the Summers case that there are even more problems with FERC issuing a conditioned certificate. Because the only way Summers accepted FERC's certificate with its conditions and also subject to different layers of review. And notwithstanding all of that, it said that the Maryland that Maryland had complied with state law and that the statute and that the state rule was or that the local zoning laws were preempted. What I'm saying is that it should have never gotten to that point. The certificate should never have reached a stage of finality because FERC should have never issued it. It should have been waiting in order for Dominion to comply with the Clean Air Act. And
that's my point. Well, we've been over this.
It
seems to me you're just arguing that Summers is wrong.
I'm trying to avoid making a collateral attack. I've challenged the case at the time, but it's very troubling to me that one federal statute, the Natural Gas Act, should be able to trump authority under another federal statute, which is the Clean Air Act.
Congress wrote it. You were an intervener in Summers, right?
Yes.
Did you argue? I'm just curious.
I did argue. The court, in fact, if you look at the briefs,
did you argue that this conditional certificate, FERC had no authority to issue it?
What we argued in Summers is, first of all, that 2-404 wasn't preempted, and second, that even if it was preempted, that the phrase in 2-404B, otherwise complies with state law, wasn't really referring to a FERC certificate. Okay. It was intended to address a situation where a state zoning board perhaps had not, taken any action on something.
Okay.
But if you read it that way, and it may be amenable to that reading, then the problem is not with FERC, but with Maryland looking at the FERC certificate and saying, instead of clarifying that that's what we mean here in what's in our SIP, we're rolling over. We're saying, you do preempt. Because I thought the reason that the prior panel remanded was precisely to get Maryland's take on what they meant by otherwise complying with state and local law.
There certainly is language in the decision that says to Maryland, identify areas that aren't preempted. But the way that I saw it was more that it was a generalization, and perhaps it was from being colored by having participated in the argument and heard the panel's questions. But the way that I read that ordering paragraph was that the court sent it back and said, we consider this certificate means that there's been compliance with state law, but Maryland, if you can show us a couple of places where it's not, you can come back to us maybe make another case. I mean, it didn't really even invite Maryland to come back. It was, I felt that the ordering paragraph I thought was very odd just because I thought that the statement of the general principle of the certificate preempting zoning law and constituting compliance with state law was something that was so broad that even though there was that language in there for the state to look at other issues, it didn't really leave them a lot of leeway or give them a lot of guidance. And I don't really even think it gave them an opportunity to come back.
You haven't sought any review of the Clean Air Act decision, either the district court decision or the agency decision in Maryland.
The Maryland decision is still under review now. There's the Clean Air permit was issued two or three months ago, and that's something that will be subject to review in Maryland courts. And so we'll be participating in that.
Anything else?
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the commission.
Good morning. May it please the court, Karen Larson, representing the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I'd like to just take a quick step back and discuss how the commission here issued a certificate of public inconvenience and necessity for a large multi-state project, the Allegheny Storage Project, that's designed to provide storage and transportation service for three local distribution companies for their need to serve their millions of end-use retail customers. Petitioner focuses solely on their disagreement with the siting of one component of that project, the Myersville Compressor Station. And in that, petitioners erroneously focus on the size of the compressor station. They equate by the fact that the Myersville Compressor Station is now sized at 16,000 horsepower as somehow being a direct corollary to the amount of capacity that's going to be provided. And that's incorrect way to view how compressor stations are sized. There's multiple factors that go into determining the size necessary for a compressor station to meet the contracted for capacity.
But isn't capacity a major factor? You need more horsepower to move if the pipeline is more tightly.
That's a factor, and each pipeline system is unique. And so
what are the other factors you were about to tell us?
Right. What the engineers need to look at are the delivery pressure requirements of the customers, the velocity ranges on the pipeline, the flow rates, and the location of the pipeline, even the location of the compressor station, even a few miles move will dictate or either increase or decrease the amount of size needed. And so this is evidenced in this case that...
Was all that analysis you just mentioned in FERC's decision?
Yes, it is. It's mostly in the environmental analysis in the alternative section where the commission discusses viable alternative sites for this compressor station. One of the viable sites was the original compressor station site, the Midland location. And if a compressor station is sited at the Midland site, it would only have required a 14,000 horsepower engine because of all the engineering factors that go into it. And so the commission, in its environmental analysis and looking at possible compressor sites, looked at the hydraulic modeling that takes into consideration all these factors, and you see how if it's located in Myersville, it has to be 6,000 horsepower to provide the contracted for capacity. If
Where
it's located in Jefferson,
mm-hmm.
it's in the EA, mostly on page 58, that's Joint Appendix 201. And then also in the certificate order, the commission discusses in paragraphs 59 and 61, Joint Appendix 360 to 361, how the commission's hydraulics modeling, review of the hydraulic modeling confirmed that the Myersville compressor at 16,000 horsepower is the amount of compression needed to serve the contracted for load.
But doesn't that just bring you back to how much gas is, right? The quantity of gas?
It's a mix of all these factors. And uh-huh. So it's not just if you have a 5,000 horsepower compressor, you're going to move X amount of gas, and then if you have 10...
It'll move slower, right, if you have less horsepower. Is that right? Does it have to do with the velocity of the gas?
Velocity is certainly one component.
Uh-huh.
And the pressure at which it arrives at the
exactly.
destination.
Exactly. So each pipeline is unique in the sense of how much pressure the gas needs to be delivered at.
Is that because different distribution systems require different amounts of pressure? In other words...
That's correct, right. The customers have different delivery requirement needs.
Once the customer, that is the distribution company, gets it, do they also have compressors that move the gas around, or does all the pressure come from the pipeline and its compressors?
My understanding is that all the pressure comes from the interstate pipeline.
Yeah.
and then it gets delivered at the gates into then their distribution system.
And that provides the compression for the whole distribution system, right? For the customer, is that?
I'm afraid I'm not certain whether on a distribution system, a local distribution company needs to have their own compression here and there. Mm-hmm. I'm just not sure. I'm not sure that it really matters that, you know, where we're talking about here, just the interstate gas pipeline.
So it's really difficult for us, I think, to review where the record doesn't have the contracts or the precedent agreements. And your policy statement says if an applicant has entered into contracts or precedent agreements for the capacity, it will be expected to file agreements in support of the project. And I just wonder why they're not here. It just seems to really complicate our job.
The commission determined that when the pipeline applicant filed sworn statements that provided the material terms of the precedent agreements, confirming that the contracts are for 100% of the project's capacity for long terms, 15-year terms, that they did not need to see all the entire contract and all the information that's contained in a contract that really isn't relevant to FERC's review. FERC, you know, when you have, it's like a question of what's the, you know, do you need to have, what's the best evidence? And there's nothing to say that being able to view the full contract is any better than having a sworn statement about the material terms that FERC needs to know and care about to confirm that this project was economically justified. And here the commission had that, and at some point commenters did object to the fact that this was what in FERC's terms is called an abbreviated application. It didn't have the full contract. And FERC in its certificate order said we had all the information we needed to confirm
that.
You're
required to demand that. I mean, even an abbreviated application has to have all the information that would support.
That's correct. And FERC confirmed that they had all the information they needed. They knew all the material terms of this contract to confirm that this project was needed.
Okay, so is that what – I was just confused as to when – why this was allowed to be abbreviated and what the implications of that were for opportunity for public input and, you know, how the commission came to think that it didn't need the full contracts here. Where is that all explained?
The most applications that come before FERC are abbreviated applications. If any application that excludes even one part of one exhibit would then be considered an abbreviated application. It doesn't mean that it's truncated. It just means that it's maybe some what is now considered superfluous exhibit is not included. FERC could have, if it felt like it didn't have the information it needed, it could have at any point asked the company to, it could have either just rejected the application for not being sufficient, or it could have most likely just asked through a data request for the company to provide the contracts. The commission did not need that. They had the information they needed before them to make the determination of need. And to your point about did it at all affect an intervener's right to participate, not at all. The whether an application is a full application or what's termed an abbreviated application does not alter in any respect FERC's review process.
Well, but doesn't it alter what information the public or interveners have at their fingertips to look at in commenting on this? They didn't have the contracts to look at.
They did not have the contracts, and certainly no one asked for the contracts. There's nothing in the record that indicates at any point along the way interveners or petitioners asked for these contracts. And if that had been the case, likely FERC would have then just submitted a data request and asked the company to provide them.
Right. So then I was curious about, because there are jurisdictional limits on our review of any argument that's not presented to the commission, both originally and on rehearing, and they say, well, we had a footnote on this contract point. And my question is is a footnote sufficient to get them over the jurisdictional bar, and then we just factor the footnote amount of information into arbitrary and capricious review, or does the jurisdiction, is there something in the jurisdictional requirement that actually requires a more comprehensive presentation of an issue to satisfy the jurisdictional bar?
A more comprehensive presentation is required. So we
jurisdictionally
would,
or just they're going to lose on arbitrary and capricious review without having said more?
The Natural Gas Act at Section 19 B limits judicial review to objections that were urged before the commission in their request for rehearing. And then at the a little bit further down, the Natural Gas Act provides that a rehearing request must set forth with specificity the grounds or grounds upon which such application is based. And this court has construed those jurisdictional provisions of the Natural Gas Act very strictly, and in this instance, the footnote was not even raising an argument. They just made the observation that the contracts weren't in the record. This was not enough to put the commission on notice that this was an objection that they were making.
I want to understand more about FERC's position on the preemption and the certificate's impact on Maryland law. On the one hand, FERC makes a certificate that is conditioned on compliance with the Clean Air Act, and part of Maryland's SIP is compliance with local law. And then, so the certificate, because they don't have the Clean Air Act clearance yet, FERC issues something that's conditional, but it seems like that condition then just falls away to the extent that your certificate has a preemptive effect over the preserved Maryland law under Maryland SIP. And it just seems like, why would it even be conditional if you can just say, actually, in this case, we don't think there's any Clean Air Act compliance, at least with respect to the SIP, needed?
This court in Dominion v. Summers, as well as the commission in its certificate and rehearing orders, determined that the commission's issuance of this conditional certificate did not interfere with the state's air quality processing. And
before you issued the certificate, Maryland said no. Then you issue the certificate, and Maryland turns around and effectively says, well, I guess FERC told us what we have to do here. So it clearly had an impact, and whether you want to give it the spin of interfere or not, it clearly affected what they were doing, or is that not your position?
My position would be that we're dealing with two federal statutes, the Natural Gas Act and the Clean Air Act, as implemented by Maryland. And what the court did in Dominion v. Summers, I believe, as Judge Tatel had suggested, as a predicate to the court's decision holding there, was that the commission's certificate was valid, and the commission is able to issue that conditional certificate. And I would think that suggests that there's no conflict, that the court in Dominion v. Summers found that there's no conflict between how the issuance of a FERC certificate then interacts with a state's review under the Clean Air Act. And to the extent that perhaps there was a conflict, I believe that the court's holding in Dominion v. Summers reconciled these statutes with the court's ultimate determination that it's left to Maryland under its state implementation plan to determine what, if anything, was left of the state, of the local town laws, zoning laws, that would allow the state to then say reject Dominion's application for not complying with 2-404B1.
So as you read Summers, could Maryland have said, oh no, we still haven't done our Clean Air Act certificate, and in fact maybe we won't issue one because this facility has not complied with applicable local law? Or would FERC's position have been, no, we've issued the certificate, that's been preempted? So do you think Maryland had latitude that it did not exercise to continue to insist on actual compliance with, as opposed to preemption with, local law?
The commission's position is that after Dominion v. Summers, the state had the latitude to determined that Dominion's application, air permit application, did not comply, still did not comply, notwithstanding the FERC certificate, still did not comply with 2-404.
They did have the latitude to
yes.
so decide.
Yes. What they did not have the latitude to do was what they had originally done, which was
we
absolutely
won't act.
Nothing.
Say we won't act. So they could decide, they have to decide, is this or is this not in compliance
right.
with
and
the
then
law.
There would be a decision that the applicant could have then sought judicial review
right.
of, and it
okay.
would have been expedited judicial review like
okay.
the original.
All right. Okay,
thank
you.
You.
We'll hear from the intervener.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Kate Stetson representing Dominion Transmission. I think I can be brief, and I can follow along with Ms. Larson's argument and supply some additional cites to the record in particular to give this Court comfort on the precedent agreement issue. But let me begin by saying we're having to chase this argument a little bit behind Petitioner, because if you look at Petitioner's briefing, the two issues that Petitioner raised in her brief had to do with the precedent agreements being out of date, which is refuted at Joint Appendix 72 and Joint Appendix 344, and with the non-filing of the precedent agreements. Now, Judge Millett, you've already pointed out that objection was raised only in a footnote. The footnote itself doesn't even make it clear that the objection goes to the non-filing of the agreements. It says there does not appear to be even sample or generic precedent agreements in the public record. So you're already having, I think, to hyperextend yourself to conclude that there was an objection, even if in a footnote. North Carolina versus FERC, this court's decision, which is on page 18 of our green brief, says that an argument is jurisdictionally forfeited if it is tucked away in a footnote. So as for the
Did I write that?
You may have, Your Honor. I confess I don't know.
I don't remember. Something I might have.
As for the out-of-date contention and the did-not-file contention, I think those have been disposed of. Now what we're hearing is that it's not clear, Ms. Elefant says from the record, that there was a contract for 100% of the capacity. It is clear from the record. If you look at Joint Appendix 96, there is a sworn statement on the part of Dominion's official that says this contract is for 100% of the capacity. That leaves the very technical elements of the 14,000 versus 16,000 horsepower issue that Ms. Larson has adequately covered. Let me also suggest that
Can you also yes. just address the Cove Point issue that was in the 28-J letters? Is there any reason to believe that some of the power generated from the Allegheny project might, in fact, reach the Cove Point facility?
Judge Pillard, I think the Commission made it clear in both its decision and its decision on rehearing that when a pipeline is not being used to 100% of its capacity, so let's say it's not maxed out on a particular day, you can't trace where a particular molecule of gas ends up. As it happens, Washington Gas has several delivery points along the pipeline that we call the Cove Point Pipeline. The fact that Washington Gas, which intervened in this proceeding, has committed to using that capacity to serve its customers suggests that it's going to be unusual for the gas to make it all the way to Cove Point. And the Commission made it very clear, and I'm indulging the assumption that this issue was even adequately raised, the Commission made it very clear that when it comes to the capacity committed for this project, that this project was 100% committed and was an independent, standalone project that, as Ms. Larson said, was also a part of a much larger storage project.
So it doesn't make any difference, then, if some of the gas ends up at Cove Point. Right?
Makes no difference
makes
whatsoever.
No difference. Even if there was record evidence that might happen, because it's committed 100%, right? But
that's correct.
It doesn't make any difference because of the way these pipelines work.
I think the Commission made it clear that it contemplated at least a hypothetical situation where gas ends up at Cove Point. But, you know, what the petitioners here appear to be raising is a NEPA segmentation problem. And, of course, they raised it quite late. Segmentation in this court is decided by looking at factors including independent utility of the project. And where, Judge Tatel, as you started this argument, where you have 100% of capacity committed, there can be no doubt but that the project has independent utility.
I know that's their rationale, but I thought our Delaware Riverkeepers decision said that we can't rely on just look at commitment to the capacity as a basis for deciding segmentation and required and rejected a number of the factors that the commission actually relied on here in making its segmentation decision. And so that's not to say that they couldn't reject the segmentation argument, but they didn't do it under Delaware Riverkeepers. And so how could we do it for them now, as opposed to having to remand at least that issue for them to address it under the proper interpretation of the law?
Your Honor, I think we have to assume for purposes of this discussion that the segmentation argument was adequately raised, and
yes.
Of course it wasn't.
Okay.
But even making that assumption, getting over that jurisdictional bar, Delaware Riverkeepers involved an extremely different set of facts than those here, including concessions that the project were related. And
no,
that
I understand
that
why it had a different outcome there. I'm focusing on what Delaware Riverkeepers said, that it was improper for the commission to rely on the fact that the energy that was being created was committed by contract, and to rely on that highway analogy, that in fact it had to look at the regulation and go through the regulatory terms in deciding a segmentation decision. Now, it came out one way in Delaware Riverkeepers. I'm not saying how it would come out here if they followed the regulations and followed the Delaware Riverkeepers decision, but they just didn't, because it came afterwards, they didn't have a chance yet to address it. And I'm trying to figure out, as a matter of Chenery review, how we could say you applied the test that we've since rejected, but that's okay.
I think it's not so much a matter of Chenery review as it is a matter of Tennessee Gas and North Carolina versus FERC forfeiture. The reason the commission didn't articulate its segmentation ruling as to Cove Point is because they never raised the segmentation
issue. But if I were
to
disagree with the preservation issue and were to think they were raised by Mr. Caddy, then what would happen? So put aside the procedural objections. Substantively, if we think we have to address segmentation, what do we do with the fact that Delaware Riverkeepers rejected most of the reasons advanced by FERC here?
I think you have to read Delaware Riverkeepers as a whole, including the particular facts there. I don't think it would be proper to import one element of that overall decision into this case and declare it determinative. The reason Delaware Riverkeepers came out the way it did was because this court found there to be evidence in the record of concessions that the projects were linked. It's to use your highway analogy, concessions that these two parts of the highway both were destined to true up together and to lead to the same point, the same logical terminus. There is no such evidence in this record. Where the issue wasn't even raised, though, I would urge the court to just invoke the jurisdictional bar rather than engage on the issue.
Okay, just one last question. You made a prudential standing argument.
We did.
And since Lexmark, I assume now you would assume we don't have to address the prudential standing issue, that that's simply an alternative ground you're advancing. And I'm not sure what to do with it because it's not jurisdictional now, and the commission didn't do it, so I don't know how we could rely on it.
Right.
I think the
tricky question after Lexmark is whether Dominion as intervener had the capacity to raise a standing issue that the commission didn't raise. I think that's still an open question in the circuit. There are cases, and you can find them in Judge Kavanaugh's dissent in the grocery manufacturer's case. Mm-hmm. There are cases that stand for the proposition that an intervener on the part of a petitioner can't bring new issues in front of the court. But there's nothing that says that an intervener in support of the defendant can't raise an issue that the defendant hasn't raised. So I think as far as jurisdiction goes, this court could still well conclude that because it was raised, it's no longer a question of jurisdiction such that the court has to reach out and decide it even if no party has raised it.
Ms. Stetson, can I just quickly ask you, is there anything in the statute that expressly speaks to whether FERC can issue a certificate in the absence of a Clean Air Act permit?
Yes. And that goes to Judge Tatel's question that he posed to Ms. Elefant. I think Judge Tatel's question was what in the statute prohibits FERC from doing this. There is, in fact, a statute that affirmatively permits FERC to do this, and it's Section 7E of the Natural Gas Act. And to the question of how this interrelates with Dominion versus Summers, if I can make one more point, of course the presence of a FERC certificate was a necessary predicate to this court's decision in Summers. That's the reason that this issue arose before the court, was because of the interrelation between the federal certificate and the state proceeding. This court made clear in Summers that it was remanding to the Maryland agency for the agency in the first instance to determine whether any of its laws were not preempted pursuant to Maryland law. The agency determined that the relevant laws were preempted and issued the Clean Air Act permit. So I think Dominion versus Summers is both controlling and right as far as that goes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Did Ms. Elephant have any time left? Probably not. You can take 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
2 minutes.
I wanted to go back to the Cove Point issue. First of all, we raised Cove Point in two contexts. We raised it with regard to segmentation, but we also argued that the fact that gas was going to Cove Point also suggested that perhaps this facility there was either being overbuilt or being built for the purpose that wasn't represented in the application. The first time the Cove Point issue was raised, and in fact it took us like months to get the CEII information, was raised by Dr. Gerner, JA325, where he talks about how at least half the gas is flowing to Cove Point, even if you take into account Washington gas, and he talks about at the end how this fact would require a new submission. Every time, to the extent that it relates to segmentation and we didn't preserve the issue, it's only because FERC continued to rebuff us. We first raised the issue of the relationship between the fact that output was going to Cove Point in the comments on the EA. FERC said in the order at Joint Appendix 325, no, there's no connection. They said again in the Joint Appendix, in the rehearing order at Joint Appendix 545, paragraph 32, we're not convinced that there's any overbuild. There's no association with Cove Point, so they said it again there. Now in our 28J filing, we submitted something that all of a sudden FERC acknowledges. Oh, yes, by the way, players use extra capacity all the time. They sell it off-peak on the market. We didn't have that information available to us, and it really changes the dynamic of how a case is presented, which I realize is not fully a legal argument. What the legal argument is that we raised these arguments to FERC, it was rebuffed, and now FERC comes back outside of the record to reconfirm a decision that it made here, presenting new evidence that we never had an opportunity to address.
Anything else? Thank you. Case is submitted.